host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockey PDOcast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me is my good buddy, Thomas Dranz. Tom, what's going on, man?
Hey, bud. In Nashville, enjoying what's got to be, like, this Canucks Predators series has got to be the weirdest series we've seen in the first round so far, right? It's just felt like there's no flow or key dynamic. In some ways, it's like every period feels like a totally different game, much less every game. The swings have been massive. Two of the three wins have felt divorced from the results or the process we've seen on the ice. It's been a really interesting one, almost like a fitful start to the series, a series that the Canucks now lead 2-1 after a big 2-1 win at Bridgestone Arena last night that I covered.
You are the hardest working man in showbiz. People should know you're up and at it. You're reporting live on scene here in Nashville. You just said the morning after last night's Game 3 victory by the Canucks, and we're going to chat about it. You and I actually, I said this on the podcast earlier this week. You and I recorded the morning after Game 1, and, you know, people are saying that they got to listen to it, that it was the best show we've ever done. But unfortunately, it never made it to the light of day because there were technical issues, and so we weren't able to release it. So you'll just have to take our word for it. But you were very prophetic in it. You dropped a bunch of takeaways and observations you saw kind of starting to materialize in Game 1 that wound up being true to form later on. We're going to talk more about those. But you're right. I think, if anything, like, you've been in-house for all three of these games, right? You've been in the rink. You've been watching them. It's probably one of those series that, listen, it's playoff hockey. And certainly if you're rooting for either of these teams or you're just watching at home, I think you can appreciate how tense it is, because it feels like every goal is just so much more magnified because there's so many fewer of them than in some of the other series. And so there's like that drama, and you've got a lot of shot blocking and hitting and physicality and all that stuff that we kind of associate with playoff hockey. So I think you can certainly appreciate it, but it probably is one of those that translates better to the live in-rink experience, I think, because of all those things. Whereas if you're watching at home, it can be kind of a little choppy, or there can certainly be large stretches where there's no real meaningful events happening. And so if you're tuning in for that, you're probably left being like, oh man, nothing's really happening. This is kind of a rock fight. But I imagine in the rink, like, you're seeing a lot of this stuff and kind of this chess match between these two teams that are trying to figure each other out and sort of duel essentially for kind of like who can control the way they're playing these games.
Yeah. I mean, I think both teams are wildly well prepared. You know, that's been sort of one of the big takeaways from me is, I mean, I had a lot of time for both Rick Tocchet and Andrew Burnett before this series, but the way both teams are, just little things, like you're seeing wingers jump and like pick off the first pass after faceoffs, you know, like you can even see little stuff like that. It's just so clearly pre-scouted, right? Like the way that the matchup game has sort of played out, kind of the way that teams have adjusted and got the rival team sort of stuck in the mud in game two and then game three, you know, the Predators forecheck, which I mean, you could find it on a milk carton in game two, like, completely savaged Vancouver last night. Rick Tocchet talking post game about needing to make some adjustments in the neutral zone and on the breakout. Like, that's a credit to the Predators, right? Sort of this series is kind of the, I guess, despite an absent key dynamic, I think one thing we've noticed is when the Predators forecheck plays, they can control play. When it doesn't, it feels like they get bogged down in Vancouver's end. And then it's so extreme once a team takes the lead. And I think it's because there are so few shots, are so few goals in this series. We're seeing some pretty extreme defensive shells when teams are leading late, and that kind of adds to the drama and adds to the probability of comebacks, you know, which really has been decisive in this series. Like, the Canucks have managed to eliminate a Predators lead in game one, entering the third period. The Predators weren't able to do that to Vancouver, you know, sort of by the skin of their teeth last night. Like, Vancouver wasn't able to pull game two close despite 25 minutes of like dizzying territorial control and a whole variety of chances. Every miss, you know, like Ryan O'Reilly shoots at an open net, but it just hits Ian Cole in the face. Right? It's like, that's so similar to like the Dakota Joshua chance at the tail end of game two, where he, you know, has his initial stop shot stopped by Saros and then hits the post, right? Those misses just loom so large in a series where there's like 40 shots both ways max.
Well, it's
in
so
any given game.
It's so funny to hear you note the coaching of this, and I completely agree. But someone in the PDOcast Discord yesterday during the game, as it was playing out, kind of made the reference to how this is kind of reminiscent of, like, remember when 3-on-3 overtime first started and it was just this like pure adrenaline rush and no one knew what to do with it. And then so it was just like playground hockey. Like we were just like going back and forth. And then coaches got an opportunity to like devise game plans and sort of sink their claws into it. And then it's become kind of what it is now. It's almost like this is essentially like the playoff series version of that, where like both of these coaches have found a way, to their credit, to really leave a lasting impression on the series. And I think that's why you're seeing how difficult it is for these teams. I've also sort of, I'd make the point that I'm not sure about momentum in terms of like game to game, because I do think, especially with days off in between, there's an opportunity for teams to reset, watch video, get back to the drawing board and kind of figure it out. But I think you are seeing the sort of lasting effect of like how what happened in one game is seeping into the next one as well, right? Because in game one, the Predators blow that third period lead. And then I think that informed their decision in game two to just park the bus and create this defensive shell the way they did in the back half of that game to preserve that lead in game two. And then in game three, you sort of saw the Canucks essentially like play the Uno reverse card on them, where it was the exact opposite. and I think part of that is also like, while I'm sure the Predators were happy after game two, anytime you win, particularly on the road in the postseason, you get a split, you're going home, you're pumped about it. I imagine Andrew Brunette was looking at that and being like, all right, it's probably not ideal that we sort of were this conservative, because this isn't the way we played all regular season. And so you knew they were going to make a point of coming out and being very aggressive in front of the home crowd in game three. And the Canucks, true to form all season, got that lead and then were able to sort of play this way. Now I'm sure Rick Tocchet is going to be preaching the same message, where it's like, it's great that we won and we're comfortable in this environment, but we probably want to have more than 12 shots on goal as well in game four. And then so it'll be fascinating to see kind of what that next domino to fall is.
Well, it was funny. Me and Harmon, who were watching the games together, and we're filing right at the buzzer, these like takeaways, quick columns at the Athletic. We're sitting there and the Canucks are just absolutely shutting the back door all night, right? Like the Predators have all this possession, but the Predators want to get DeSmith moving laterally before they're shooting. And they're not really testing him even from dangerous areas as much as they're sort of trying to make one extra play, right? To make their shot more dangerous, which by the way, I don't think is necessarily a bad approach, but the Canucks were living, in those lanes, like their ability to shut the back door last night. And I think the Predators' sort of slow adjustment, finally Evangelista scored on exactly the type of play I'm talking about. The Predators felt a little bit slow to adjust to just testing the goaltender. And like after the game, Rick Tocchet comes out and he says, you know, we weren't good in the neutral zone. We weren't good on the breakout, but we were good in the defensive zone. And that's exactly what Harmon and I had been talking about, which is sort of similar to like game two. I didn't feel like the Canucks had quote unquote dominated the way it felt like everyone else who'd watched the game was talking about. I thought Vancouver, for all of the time they spent in their own end for like their ineptitude, frankly, breaking the puck out, like an uncharacteristic level of ineptitude. And that's something we'll get into. I thought their defensive zone coverage was legitimately very strong, and the Predators, just their execution was just off. Like there were a couple of times, I don't know if this showed up on TV, but there were a couple of times where like on sort of a rush chance with a defenseman either having just changed or coming in sort of late, taking fourth man's ice, like they just got missed, and the Predators lost a really high quality scoring chance as a result. That they did lose, the Canucks did lose a Predators forward right in front of the net with about 30 seconds to play, and the Predators just didn't quite clock it. The margins in this series are fine, and I thought the Canucks' defensive zone coverage was good. I also thought Nashville's offensive execution was uncharacteristically off, And, you know, we'll see in game four. One thing about this series is you're right that I think there's an evolution of game plans that we're seeing across a game by game basis, but the flow, the momentum, the way the series has looked game to game has been almost completely different. Which brings us kind of to the one takeaway. This is just something I want to ask you about. I've been thinking a lot because for those who know me, I cover the Canucks, right? So, and I worked for the Panthers before that. And so with the exception of the bubble in 2020, like I haven't really covered like a Canucks playoff series in a long time. I'm trying to like think about how to talk about small sample hockey, right? A lot. With this game three coming right on the heels of a game two that, as you said, the Uno reverse card effect of it, I feel like I've seen Nashville's best attribute, right, which is their ability to generate scoring chances 5-on-5, kind of pitted against Vancouver's best attribute, which is the ability to lock things down 5-on-5 and drag a game into the mud. And game two, I saw a lot of the Canucks, or game two, I saw sort of the Canucks have to chase against the Predators. And you know, Vancouver doesn't generate a lot 5-on-5 offensively. The Predators have been good defensively, but sort of shaky in terms of the environment that they create to their for their goaltender relative to how the Canucks do it. And it just felt like the Canucks were more dangerous pressing in game two than the Predators were in game three. Like it almost felt to me like we got to see a pretty raw distillation of both teams' best thing last night. And I think I like Vancouver's best thing. Like, I think Vancouver's strength is stronger than Nashville's strength in this series. As just like a takeaway, just like one of my game three takeaways was that, fair or unfair, because you know, I'm not saying it with a ton of certainty, given that at the end of the day, it's just one game and a game the Canucks won despite having 12 shots because DeSmith played the game of his life.
I think that's very fair, and it's reflected at both ends of the spectrum as well, right? Because
Right.
the Canucks, while we've talked a lot this season about how they're so much better suited for getting up early and then protecting that lead and then sort of hammering that playing style, if you saw how game two unfolded, like the way they were able to sort of build on that offensive zone time and then get a bunch of shots, I'm with you that I don't think they really were. I don't think it was a great game plan by them because they were sort of playing right into Nashville's hands. And you know, I made that note about how you were very prophetic after game one and talking about it. What the reference was there was you were noting how Nashville had totally changed up their defensive zone scheme where they were fronting significantly more the way Vegas does, and essentially just baiting the Canucks into taking all of these spray and pray shots from the point in the perimeter. And they were just living in the lanes, absorbing all of them, not even letting anything get to Saros. And that's how you got this sort of comical stat where it's like they had more shots blocked than shot attempts until like the final minute of that game, essentially, right? And
Right.
it looks bad on paper because they're not generating much themselves, but being up 3-0, they were very comfortable playing that way. But the Canucks are able to sort of build on that way. When the Canucks go up like they did in game three, they're able to sit back and defend, and that's not necessarily what Nashville wants to get into from their own offensive generation perspective, right? Like there weren't that many actual rush opportunities and ability for them to get out in transition because the Canucks were very comfortable just sitting back and spending time in the defensive zone and taking away all the dangerous options. And so it looks good that Nashville finally wound up getting the 30 shots. That's much more sort of in line with their regular season numbers from a generation perspective. But ultimately, I know like Ryan O'Reilly got a few very good looks in tight and it had a few empty nets. And if he hits one or two of them, all of a sudden, maybe it's a different story. But also, I think you hit the nail on the head there in terms of like these two games kind of showing the difference in what the teams are comfortable with, where they're best at, and then how that's related to sort of the game script.
And you know, this Canucks team, I think they have hit this defensive level where they can, whether they play well or not, all of these games feel like they're one shot games. Like they're coming down to one shot, right? Now, obviously, there's multiple instances where it could be that one shot, but the point being that the margin is non-existent. There is no margin in these games. It is. And I don't want to say down to luck, but it's down to execution. It's down to whether you like that, because Ryan O'Reilly hits Cole in the face on the 5-on-3 chance, but he also has that sitter that he puts just wide in the first 7 minutes, right? The JT Miller goal, so key, because the first goal is so key in this series. Like, it's a Nashville clear. JT Miller attempts the same shot. He did it twice because they were in sort of a wedge, which means they were skinny. The Nashville penalty kill was skinny. Whenever he sees that, he's going to spam that downhill wrist shot. Like, mm-hmm. that's how JT Miller thinks. He doesn't try it as often against diamonds. You have to work to set it up against a diamond. Miller knows that right away. And so he's spamming that shot. He gets one. It's blocked. The Predators have a chance to clear, and they just clear it directly into Quinn Hughes. Like, I don't even know if Quinn Hughes saw it. He didn't even make, because Quinn Hughes is amazing at like playing shortstop at the blue line and sort of keeping clearance attempts in zone. But this wasn't one where he had to do that. It's like, you know, there's 50 feet of ice, but there's Quinn Hughes right there, and it just hits him. I swear, I don't even know if he saw it or had a chance to react to it. It was just that the Preds penalty killer put it into the one spot he couldn't. And then Miller takes the shot again. It's a beauty. And the opening goal, like, these games are coming down to one play, one shot. And what I'm curious to see in a world where the Canucks advance, for example, is like, can they muddy it up against a team like Edmonton if that happens to the point where it's a one shot game? Because if it is, you know, that's advantage to a team like Vancouver, right? Like, that's not what a team with the best hockey playing human on the planet and another top five guy and another 50 goal scorer want to see. They don't want a game against a less skilled team to come down to one shot, one bounce. But that's sort of what it's looked like in this series, which honestly, coming out of game three, I mean, the Canucks will have a tremendous opportunity to take a stranglehold in game four here, but this one just feels like it's going to go longer than this, because I can't see the difference between these two teams. It's very much the corporate wants you to identify the difference between these two pictures, right? Like, there is no difference between these two teams right now.
Well, I was going to say the minimal margin of hockey is like, I think of that Bane quote about darkness, and it's like the Canucks are essentially being like, you've adopted it. Like, I was born in this darkness. Like, they're so much more comfortable in this type of environment. It's by design, right? And I think that's,
yep.
I've seen a lot of conversation about, like, we sort of noted it off the top about how maybe when you're watching on TV some of these games, you look at the shot clock, right? And it's like 7-6, and it's like halfway through the second period, and it's 1-0. You're like, oh man, this is ugly. I'm seeing very few sequences where there's back and forth action, where teams are actually stringing together passes. And I've seen, I think, people mischaracterize that as the reason behind it being Nashville not being talented enough compared to this Canucks team, right? I think that's been, especially in this market, been a big topic of conversation about the two teams' respective talent levels and how Nashville is sort of being quote unquote out talented in this. And I just don't think that's the case at all. Like, no. I think the Canucks certainly have a ton of individual talent, as you see, and you're familiar with the names, you're going to see that at the end of season awards. But it's a mischaracterization, because it's like just a misunderstanding of what made this Canucks team so successful and effective this year. And it was like their workmanlike mentality and grinding stuff out and winning in that type of way, as opposed to being this sort of skill team that just puts up crooked numbers on you on the scoreboard. And so I think the reason why these games are playing out this way and why they're so ugly in some sense is because of the Canucks, actually, and not the Predators. And that's not an insult at all, right? Like, I think that's a testament to the job Rick Tocchet's done. I think it shows how much more comfortable they are. And we talk about this all the time in these playoff series, right? It's like the team that is sort of able to steer the game state into their preferred pace and environment is going to be the one that wins, right? Like, you want to force your opposition to play your game. And it feels like that's what the Canucks are doing here. Even in a game where they got outshot 30-12, the Predators, especially like in that final 5 to 7 minutes or so, I think they'd start to break through a little bit and kind of get some looks. But ultimately, like, this is the type of game where I think the Canucks are not only comfortable playing, but would prefer, and maybe even especially so, without their starting goalie, right? Where they're trying to sort of insulate their backup and make life easier for them, as opposed to exposing them to this situation where they're trading rush chances with a Predators team and all of a sudden they get themselves into trouble.
Yeah, like I almost wonder if the Predators need to insert some recklessness, because as much as the Canucks will be super disciplined about making conservative puck management decisions, like, there are opportunities that you can't resist. Like, and I almost wonder if the Predators at some point are going to need to take a chance, like, leave themselves vulnerable to a 2-on-1 or a 3-on-2, you know, in order to get the opportunity to counter. Like, we're sort of reaching that stage at this point, just because even when the Predators are dominating possession the way they did yesterday, like, they had 7 or 8 shots in the final 7 minutes, right? Like, it wasn't until the final 5 minutes that the Predators really started to feel like they were putting Vancouver under duress. You know, Vancouver was under siege in the first period and sort of for the last 5 minutes of the third. But in between that, it felt like Vancouver was very much comfortable playing Canucks hockey, and Canucks hockey is not Miller and Pettersson and Hughes and the quote unquote skilled players for the Canucks doing fancy things. It's a 1-2-2 deep, herd the team into the neutral zone, right? And lock things down. I felt like Vancouver locked things down for the vast majority of time as they just killed clock in that game. And that's got to be frustrating for Nashville, even as I think the Predators should come out of that game with, you know, an awful lot of things working in their favor, like things that they will feel, guys like O'Reilly who've won Conn Smythe, guys like Shen who have cups, guys like McDonough who have cups, they'll come out of parts of that game thinking, hey, we dropped that one, but there's a lot of stuff that we think is going to matter for us as this series goes along. And Hughes struggling to break the puck out in particular, something we never see, like never see, I think would be top of that list. I think we actually should talk more about that, but I assume we got to go to break.
No, well, I just got one more point on this, then we'll go to break, and then we'll talk about Hughes. I can tell that you have your own radio show here, because you've got all the beats hit here.
Managing the clock,
of course. What I was gonna say though is, I actually do think the Predators, you can always kind of go more extreme, but I think they have tried to bait the Canucks into playing their game, because you're still seeing, like, in the offensive zone, for example, they are still trying to pinch and forecheck really aggressively, and they're committing guys down low, which is opening up neutral zone space for the Canucks in their own zone.
Yes.
Whenever they get the puck, their forwards are flying the zone, and they're trying to kind of stretch out the Canucks and hit those long
bombs. They've
done
that well, actually.
But the thing is like, the Canucks are generally not falling for the trap. They did in game one a little bit, funny enough. Like, I think, like, it was a clear feeling out process. I think of, like, there were a few instances where I think they got Tyler Myers on, like, he jumped in on a 3-on-2, for example, and, like, created this rush chance. And it's like, all right, well, that's good. But also, I think the Predators will live with that. And in fact, they would prefer for the Canucks to engage in that and sort of embrace it, because then that's going to open up stuff for them. And the Canucks have been really disciplined and meticulous about not really falling for it for the most part in these three games, and making those sort of puck management decisions accordingly. And so that's why you're getting these games where the shots on goal so far are 22-21 Preds, 18-16 Canucks, and then 30-12 Preds. But scoring chances so far, I've got them 52-49 for the Canucks, which shows you how tight I think it's been. Now, to put those numbers into perspective, in three games, same as this series, the Oilers have 92 scoring chances against the Kings, compared to 52-49. So just to give you some perspective, obviously two different series, but I think that also sort of shows you how these games are being played and how wildly different they are. And so it's just a remarkably low event game environment. And this also isn't something, like, I think we spent so much time talking about how the Canucks were not a one trick pony, but sort of the margin for error for them was lower because they had to play one specific way and they hadn't really proven that they could thrive in different environments. The same in an inverse can kind of be said about the Predators, right? They were such a high volume team and so aggressive offensively this season that they would just, I think, get teams to kind of play that way. And then that benefited them, and they never really were forced to or able to play this way before. And so that's why when they get into a game two, when they're trying to protect a lead and they're, like, parking the bus and a bit scarred by blowing a lead in game one, I think that's why they looked so bad as a result. It wasn't so just stuck. That they were being conservative. It's that, like, they really had no idea how to play that way, right? And so I think that's like the regular season is used as kind of a testing ground for this stuff to prepare you for the playoffs. And I think that's what you're seeing in these games.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. And I think the Predators can't turn the dial, right? They need to play aggressively all game long, in my view, if they're going to win this series. Like, they really need to tattoo the old John Tortorella safe as death saw, like, on the inside of their eyelids. Whether they're up or not, they have to keep blowing the zone. They have to keep those aggressive pinches at the blue going, because I just don't feel like they have that B game to drive play without it.
No, they don't. Okay, let's take our break here. And then when we come back, we'll jump right back in. We're going to keep chatting with you. You're listening to the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network. All right, we're back here in the Hockey PDOcast with Thomas Drance. Tom, we were sort of hinting at this before we went to break, but you were talking about Quinn Hughes and his breakouts and how that's being challenged as the series progresses. Now, Natural Stat Trick somehow has him down for 7 hits taken in these 3 games. I believe they had him down for like 3 in the first period yesterday. I'm skeptical.
And then no more.
That. Yes. I'm skeptical on that, though.
Like, I saw Sissons dump him in the second. I promise you. The NHL recorded no hits against Quinn Hughes in game 1. And I saw him get mashed multiple times. Like, the Predators have been on it all series. I wonder if some of it's happening away from the puck, maybe more than I even realize.
Right.
But I don't think the hits numbers are accurately reflecting the size of the target that the Predators have put on Hughes's back over the course of the series. And last night was the most noticeable, not just because they tagged him twice off the opening shift, but because all night long they were in his grill. And these hits aren't dirty, but they are hard. They are hard hits. The Predators are coming hard at Vancouver's top pair.
Yeah, they are finishing their checks, certainly. And it's clearly a concerted kind of point of emphasis for them in their game plan. And it should be. You see this in the postseason, certainly, right? Like, what Vegas has done essentially the last 2 postseasons to Dallas's most skilled defensemen and going after them. And you think in particular, not only to the volume that Quinn Hughes shoulders like all season in terms of ice time, in terms of how often he has the puck on his stick, how responsible he is for everything on the breakout and really in all zones. But let's say particularly in this case, in the defensive zone where he's most likely to be hit. And it makes sense that would be, especially in a 7-game series, that the cumulative effect of that, I think, is real. And I'm sort of curious after game 3 to see whether that results in him potentially getting rid of the puck more quickly and trying to kind of make shorter, safer plays as opposed to his usual where he holds on to the puck longer than any other defenseman because he's constantly kind of keeping his dribble alive like Steve Nash, right? Kind of moving around the zone, trying to get open, trying to probe, and then eventually attacking when that presents itself. And like, listen, he still in a lot of these, I think, does a good job of protecting himself because he's so elusive that he's able to like spin off of it and he's just got such a good feel for it. But they're certainly getting home on these much more than I think we're used to all season. So regardless of what the total is, I think they must be happy with how they're executing that part of the game plan. And I'm curious to see, I guess you're arguing that you already started to see some of the effects of it in game 3, but I'm curious to see how that progresses and sort of whether it forces any changes in the game plan and the way the Canucks themselves are operating to sort of protect him a little bit, just because of how important he is to everything they do.
So when you consider that Quinn Hughes had the puck for what, like 50 more minutes than the next closest defenseman, and how rarely he takes contact relative to how frequently he carries the puck, I mean, there's a slipperiness that's sort of definitional in terms of what to expect when watching Quinn Hughes. Like, he's a master at avoiding contact. That they're getting home like this so frequently on him, you know, to me is a product of like, this is game 85 and this guy plays huge minutes. And we all know that over the course of a long season, there's going to be wear and tear and attrition, especially on the highest usage players in the NHL. I saw Quinn Hughes go glassing out last night. I'd never seen Quinn Hughes go glassing out. It was so uncharacteristic. And I think that's sort of the bear case, right? If you're going to watch game 3 from the perspective of like the nervous Nelly Canucks fan, right? The like fatalistic Canucks fan who just like can't get over all the accumulated scar tissue of 54 years. If there's signal that could be negative for the Canucks over the balance of the series, it's sort of the idea of this, which is, what would it look like if Vancouver's one-man breakout machine was no longer able to, you know, for whatever reason, warp the environment of the game, right? Exert their usual gravity on just like, I'm going to individually transport this puck, and now we're set up for a heavy shift, and now the forwards are changing, and now we've had the puck in the offensive zone for 90 seconds, which is just like a Quinn Hughes special at this point. What would it look like if the Canucks didn't have that weapon in their bag, that arrow in their quiver? I think it might look a lot like last night. And so, Vank, that, like, to me, that's sort of line item one of things that if we see again in game four, if we see again in game five, will augur badly for the Canucks. If the dynamic of this series does not include Quinn Hughes and Philip Peronic being able to at will flip the play, you know, and if these hits over the course of the series serve to mute or at least turn down the volume of Quinn Hughes's usual loud impact, I think that's, you know, that's a recipe for a 7-game series and a series that's going to be decided in a wash of sort of coin flip games. And I don't think you want that if you're Vancouver with a 2-1 series lead at this point.
Well, I think part of it is game planning in the postseason, where you're preparing for the same opponent. You can really be more aggressive and sort of like intentional with your design in this stuff. And so I think that's why Nashville is having a bit more success, because I don't think this is necessarily anything new, right? I imagine every team that was playing the Canucks this season was like, we need a point of emphasis for us tonight if we're going to be effective, is to give Quinn Hughes trouble. We can't just let him yes. hold on to the puck and have fun. But good luck getting into him in the first place, right? He's just so good, right, as you said, at dodging those and getting free. And so the fact that Nashville is getting there as often as they have, increasingly so as this postseason series goes along, is interesting. I think that also feeds into the Canucks 5-on-5 offense, which I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, because I think that was something we were going to be looking for heading into the series. Now, I think both teams have scored five such goals so far, and that kind of speaks to just like how tight and narrow the margin is. And I think the Canucks can get away with it in this series because they're so good defensively, and Nashville doesn't have necessarily many other avenues for creating themselves. But if you're just thinking about a longer playoff run or potentially facing Edmonton in round two or even anything beyond that, I think that's something that they're going to have to figure out. And maybe there are no other options, because this has been kind of a trend for them in the second half of the season, where the offensive generation of 5-on-5 has really kind of stagnated and dried up, and they become much more of a get the puck up high, shoot from the point, hope for the best team. And yeah, it makes a little bit of sense in this series, as we've spoken about, because I think one of UC Saros' relative trouble spots is because he's so small, dealing with all this traffic in front of him. The Canucks are so good at getting bodies out there, creating issues for him, taking away his eyes, and then trying to get the puck past him. So it makes sense in this series. But I also think, like, you see the limitations of it sometimes, like in a game two, where it's like, yeah, you're going to get a lot of shots, but what did it ultimately amount to? And so I think it's a bit of a dangerous game, or a kind of like a needle that they're trying to thread here. And that's a bit of an issue for me.
Yeah, which sort of brings us to the adjustment that swayed game, like naturally dovetails with the adjustment that swung game three, which was the Canucks bumping Connor Garland off of PP1 and replacing him with Elias Lindholm. Lindholm, I thought, had a really tough night, but he also had extreme defensive deployment, and they were in a shell for the whole game. So it's kind of hard to contextualize, but right. I you know, he led the Canucks in ice time too, 5-on-5, but they flip Garland and Lindholm, which results in a change in formation. When Garland is in, because of his passing from down low, the Canucks use him at the net front, right? The pint sized net front guy. Sort of a very NHL in 2023 lineup decision that the Canucks have been rolling with for, you know, about 10 games, maybe the last 9 games of the regular season plus 3, so 12 games. They switch that up, and Brock Besser, who is significantly wider and significantly larger, goes to the net front. He's the screener on the Miller goal, and in fact, Miller, on that downhill shot, if you watch it, he times the release for when Saros looks right around Besser, and then he shoots it far side to the left, with the idea being that literally Saros shouldn't see this until it's past him. Brilliant, brilliant operating from Miller shooting through that layer of traffic, and then Besser gets the key insurance marker, the game winner, on a really cool little move at the net front, just sort of freeing his stick up. But the feed by Miller is gorgeous. And if you watch sort of that replay, like there's a replay from sort of an ice level, you can see that Miller never gives the play away with his eyes. Like it, yep. It was, we talked a little bit on the podcast that never aired, which was so good, about all the deception on every Evangelista touch on the power play. Well, if Evangelista has, you know, the 101 class down on that, like what we saw from Miller is like the PhD level. And what we see from Kucherov on an every game basis is like deity level, but you know, that it was that level of playmaking from Miller. So moving Besser down to the net front really swung that game, really got the Canucks power play going, which, you know, isn't a surprise. I know Kevin Woodley thinks Besser's been one of the most effective screeners in the league. So I'm guessing that's a reflection of clear sight data, and he's right. I mean, Besser sort of has played everywhere for the Canucks on the power play over the years. He kind of was, he came into the league as a left flank trigger man, like a high volume one-time option. And his one-timer was never as dangerous as his wrist shot. And as Miller sort of mastered, you know, that part of the ice, it dislodged Besser. I don't think he embraced right off the hop being this net front guy. And then slowly, especially after the club lost Tyler Toffoli, and he got reps there, you know, his work as a playmaker from down low became really good. Like he became really essential in Bo Horvat's goal scoring explosion because of the sort of low to mid pass that opened things up for Horvat from down low. And now his screen game has gotten like really imposing. He was a big factor in Vancouver's power play getting off the schneid last night. That was a key adjustment, like the key adjustment. You sort of try to, after the Canucks adjusted their first power play unit at practice, you know, it didn't trigger in my mind that Besser at the net front could swing game three, but it did. That was a timely flip-flop of personnel for the Canucks, one that paid massive dividends right off the hop.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't score a power play goal in about 12 man advantage minutes in games one and two combined. Yeah. And then they scored both their goals in this 2-1 win on the power play. So that's obviously the big difference there. And I think it extends beyond that because we mentioned the 5-on-5 kind of struggles. The power play, it's sort of, I think, more quietly maybe for like league-wide audiences. I'm sure like the local one was certainly quibbling about this. And we saw a lot of them like tinkering with moving guys around and trying different stuff down the stretch. But they were 24th in power play efficiency as well from the All-Star break on. And so getting that going and squeezing more out of a personnel group that theoretically should be much more lethal than it had been for a while now is important. Should give a bunch of credit to JT Miller as well, right? Like that was such a alpha performance, I thought, in terms of just like how much of everything they did revolved around him. Now, listen, they had 12 shots on goal as a team, but he had 6 of those shots himself. 13 chances as a team. He either took or contribute or set up 9 of them, had the goal, had the primary assist on the second goal. Everything ran through him and he was a monster. Yep. And so that was a big difference. And listen, like it's interesting in the matchup game here in this series is we've been noting in games 1 and 2, we saw so much Miller versus McCarron, right? And now in game 3, the Predators, I think, astutely realized, like, listen, this is probably our biggest exposure. And so we saw a lot more Ryan O'Reilly against Miller. I believe like they played nearly 7 minutes head to head 5-on-5 in game 3. And so I'm curious to see how that progresses as well, because early on in the series, we basically saw as neatly as you can head to heads of Miller versus McCarron. And then we saw O'Reilly versus Garland and Joshua's line with Lindholm. And then we saw Pettersson versus Sissons, right? And so how that plays out, I think, moving forward will also be very telling, like how Brunette's feeling about this and then what the Canucks can do with that.
Yeah, and I think the Canucks protected. I actually think the Canucks got away from the Miller-McCarron agreement that Brunette and Tocchet had in games 1 and 2, right off the hop, like one of the reasons they've played so frequently against one another is that both coaches have been pretty disciplined about every period McCarron starts, right? And every period the Canucks had answered on home ice with Miller last night. Tocchet, knowing full well that Brunette's going to start the McCarron line, starts Lindholm. Like, I think he kind of reset the deck. I actually think, even though it's the Predators on home ice, I think that subtle decision contributed to freeing up, Miller from sort of having to just like duel with a big bodied, sort of defensively oriented fourth line guy like McCarron. And sort of by the time you get to the end of the game, you know, McCarron's primary head to head matchup was still Miller. Like, that was still what Nashville seemed to be looking for with their fourth line. It's just that Miller ends up playing more against O'Reilly because in some ways there hasn't been very hard matchups at any point throughout this series. It's been relatively soft with sort of a lean toward things like Sissons versus Pettersson and Lindholm versus O'Reilly. And then that arithmetic switched as we got to game three in Nashville. And I would suggest to you, like, I think it's the Canucks. As much as Brunette had a little more control, from the evidence, from the fact that McCarron's primary head-to-head was still Miller, but the Canucks were able to free up Miller for other minutes. Like, I think it was the Canucks ducking that matchup, which is wild to say, but that's honestly what I think. I think that's part of what we saw last night.
Well, would you say that Sissons and Zucker in particular getting the better of Pettersson's line to the degree they have through these three games is probably the most staggering development of the 2024 postseason so far?
Probably. Probably. I mean,
let me give you the numbers. So 16 head to head minutes so far at 5-on-5 in these three games. Shots are 12-1 Nashville, goals 2-0. And I just think it's bizarre. And I think there's a lot more at play here. Like, obviously, Pettersson himself is going to be the lightning rod for criticism here, partly because of the mistakes he made that wound up costing them in game two. Also, after he got his new deal and his reputation and expectations for him, like, you just need him to produce, right? And in the postseason, there's no real time for process in terms of, like, because I could make an argument that I'd be much more concerned about him if he wasn't involved in any of these plays at all. Like, I think he's had a few opportunities. He's had some chances along the way. The puck's bounced on him. He hasn't converted. And I'd be much more worried if none of that was happening. Then I'd be like, oh man, like, he's just not even in the picture at all. That's more concerning than when you are getting opportunities but not converting, even though this alternative is kind of frustrating. But for me, like, the concern here is you just have to ultimately produce at the end of the day. That's what you're going to be judged on in the postseason, right? It's like, it's a results business. You have to win 4 out of 7 games. And if you're a top player and you're not producing, he has one secondary assist in 3 games so far. I believe, what, 3 shots on goal total, now a bunch of attempts and chances that haven't made it on net or have been blocked. But he just has to, at the end of the day, be better. And I would expect him to. But I also would have said the same after game one and after game two. And so now we're reaching a point where he ultimately just needs a signature performance because that's what he's paid to do.
So I asked Rick Tocchet last night, sort of a long-winded question, probably longer-winded than it needed to be, but I was trying to get something pretty specific from him where, you know, Miller coming into game three and, like, Besser coming into game three had 2 shots on goal, right? Miller had 1 point. The Canucks had scored 1 5-on-5 goal with Miller on the ice. Like, there just wasn't much happening for Vancouver's top players. And sort of, I put it to him as like, you're coming off a game 2 loss. You haven't seen this group respond to adversity in the playoffs. You're without Demko. What does it mean to you? What does it tell you about your group to get this big performance from your top of the lineup stars? And let me read you his answer and tell me if you think it's an answer about JT Miller and Brock Besser or an answer about Elias Pettersson. I'll let you decide. Here's the answer. If you look at the Conn Smythe winner last year, Rick Tocchet began, Jonathan Marchessault, he didn't score the first 6 games of the playoffs. I think when Chicago won their cups, I think Jonathan Toews didn't score for 8 games. Star guys are going to go through that. But if you watch them, they stick with it. You have to have other parts of your game. So that's our guys and they're learning. if you're not scoring offensively, you've got to make sure you're good in other parts of your game. Then today, Millsy and Brock have a good game for us. That's just a lesson for our guys, whoever that's struggling. Make sure that other parts of your game are really good, and eventually the offense will come. Is that an answer about Miller or Patterson? You tell me. That.
That's a lesson for our guys. Wink, wink.
Whoever.
Yeah. Whoever's listening, whoever this could be about.
Yeah.
I mean, here's the thing. I think it's, and I think you agree with this. Like, on the one hand, because of who he is, it's going to come down to him. I do think you need to view this through the context of his situation, where mm-hmm. he's clearly going through it a little bit, but there's no rhythm that's really helping him out, or no kind of like cushion for him to land on, because they start with like Lafferty and then McCabe's with him, and Hoglander's clearly, like a lot of young players, have kind of fallen out of the trust circle if you just look at his ice time. Yep. And how little he's playing, similar to what's going on with Tommy Novak and Brunette on the other side. And now he's in this spot where he feels, I'm sure, like he has to do everything himself because he has no support. They're mixing and matching all these combinations early on. They were trying to bring back the Lotto line as well. And then you just kind of get in your own head and it all accumulates and snowballs. And then you get to this position, right? And so I think that's not to like alleviate him of any criticism, because he certainly needs to produce more. At the end of the day, though, I think it's a bit more complicated than just like looking at his production so far and being like, oh, well, it's all his fault. Like, I do think he's not really being put in necessarily in a position here where you would be able to thrive. So I don't know. How do you feel about that?
I mean, I do agree that his usage has like reflected what you'd try with someone who's on the top of their game and feeling it. And it's clear that he's not. The defensive gaps, though, which weren't right. evident last night, but certainly were in games one and two. Those are so uncharacteristic, and that I find harder to explain. Right. That to me is different than the production thing. At least we saw him make one really creative play last night. He had that setup to Nils Hoglander that was absolute, like a buttery setup that Hoglander like just couldn't finish. And it was a fabulous save. Probably UC Saros's best save on the evening. So at least you're seeing flashes if you squint and like look for it with the most optimistic possible lenses. But you know, there's just not enough going on there. And if Sissons versus Pettersson remains a huge edge for Nashville 5-on-5 in this series, well, it's going seven. Like, I don't know what else to say. Like, that's going to pull the Canucks into a longer series than they want, and severely limit their margins even further, especially because we've already hit the point where, you know, Miller-McCarron looks like a matchup that the Canucks would prefer to avoid. And we all know that O'Reilly versus whether it's versus Lindholm or Miller has been a draw at best from a Canucks perspective. So they need more. They need more. And I think Tockett's commentary there in a question that was not about Elias Pettersson, but is hard to read in any other way. You know, I think the message there is the two-way game, man. Like, we got to stop the bleeding in that matchup. And then we'll worry about the offense. And I think his point is well made in that, you know, this is what happens. Like, if you're going to go deep in the playoffs, you are going to have a star player be quiet, right? If you think about the Canucks in 2011, it was Kessler in the Nashville series. It was the Twins against San Jose that went nuke, right? Mm-hmm. If you think about like that Lightning run, remember that Lightning run and LeCavalier like didn't have a goal for the first 10 games of their run and then just took over the Eastern Conference final. You know, if you're going deep, you're going to have different times for different guys. And it certainly doesn't feel like a Pettersson series right now. But if he can at least find that two-way game, if he can at least start to drive a territorial edge against Sissons, that would be a game changer. Like, that would be a game changer whether or not he's the guy breaking games open or not in this series. And Tockett seems to want to focus on those baby steps, at least if I'm reading the intention behind his quote the right way.
Yeah, a little help would be nice. And I do think Hoglander's...
A little help would be nice, no question.
Hoglander's activity in Game 3, I did think was at least encouraging, right? He had that chance that you mentioned that was set up by Pettersson. He drew the penalty. Like, it seemed like he was frustrating yep. and protecting the puck a little bit more. And so, like, they clearly need more of that. But yeah, that's something certainly to watch. Yes. Anything from... the Predators perspective. We got to wrap up here soon, but whether it's talking about Evangelista, who I think has honestly been Nashville's most dangerous player in these three games, yeah, and is certainly gonna be like garnering a lot more attention. I think, like, we've been talking about him here plenty. I think people are going to become much more familiar with him moving forward, but he's been phenomenal. Any other stuff? I'm kind of surprised that they haven't mixed up their D pairs a little bit more to help out Lozon and Carrier, because I feel like they're just throwing them so far in the deep end and they're very mistake prone, I think, can be pressured into more mistakes. That's something I would be trying to, we talked about how the Predators are targeting Hughes. I would be targeting that pair as aggressively as I could, and we've already seen a few of their mistakes lead to critical goals for the Canucks. But any other stuff from the Predators angle in terms of like usage or matchups or stuff you're watching for moving to game 4?
I'm watching for Tommy Novak's minutes. That's sort of the one part of what Nashville's been doing that I'm struggling to understand, because I think he's been pretty engaged physically. Maybe not in game 1, but certainly game 2, game 3, I thought he started looking for hits, getting involved in sort of that side of the game a little bit more. You'd think that the coaching staff would want that, would like that. And yet his minutes remain scant. And I think the Predators are going to need that skill. You know, the Predators, I think, are very much right there. And I think this series is extremely close. And I think it's going to probably go long, like longer than I'd like, in terms of having to make an extra trip.
The travel for games 5, 6, 7 will be grueling. Yeah.
Yeah. Which I love Nashville. I just don't love the travel. Yeah. It's hard to get to from Vancouver.
Here's my note on that, because I think there's something tragically ironic, and this isn't exclusive to just Novak and Brunette and the Preds, but like a guy like him, I get why the coach winds up not trusting him in the defensive zone. And so you look at like the deployment, Karen's just getting all the D zone draws, and then they're like trying to like situationally put Novak out there in the offensive zone. But the issue is that the Predators need to get out on the move and attack off the rush more and create in transition.
Yeah.
And Novak and Evangelista are probably their best bet for taking the puck from their own zone and making that happen and like enabling that. And it's not going to be McCarron's line, but because they don't trust them to start there, they don't really get into those opportunities where they can actually functionally transition the puck that way and transport it. And so that's unfortunate, because you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot. And I think it's just, it's bonkers. Like, I know, like, you're talking about how the Canucks are trying to free up Miller from that matchup. I just, McCarron playing this much more than Novak through three games is truly staggering, in my opinion. And so for Predators,
yeah,
they need to create more offense.
Like, trailing throughout.
Yeah.
Especially in a game where they're trailing throughout. And again, I've been really impressed with how the Predators have approached this series with Brunette in general. But I, you know, one thing I'm just watching for is, it feels like that middle six for them has been a difference maker, whether it's Zucker, whether it's Beauvillier, whether it's Sissons, whether it's Evangelista, Novak. It feels like those minutes have been when the Predators have looked most dangerous in some ways, because of the fact that the top of the lineup's kind of getting played to a draw by that Lindholm-Miller soft match. And because their fourth line has done like a creditable job in difficult deployment, like that bottom six needs to be heard from. And, you know, the opportunities haven't been as large as I think their territorial edge has been. Like, there's a little bit of dissonance there. I'm really curious to see if that adjusts, and if Nashville's middle six can keep having this level of 5-on-5 success territorially. And frankly, they've also been able to generate a bottom line through three games going forward.
Okay, Tom, well, we got to get out of here, so I'm going to let you go. Everyone, go check out Thomas Rantz on Twitter. Listen to Canucks Talk here on the Sportsnet Radio Network on 650, and follow his coverage of this series at The Athletic. Tom, we're going to check in with you again soon. Have fun out there. Try not to get in too much trouble in Nashville. That's all for another week of shows here for us. Thank you to Tom for coming on. Thank you to the listeners for coming along for the ride for us. Enjoy this weekend of games, and we'll be back on Monday with plenty more of the Hockeypedia cast here on the Sportsnet Radio Network.